I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This morning, President Obama said the shooting death of Trayvon Martin in Florida was a tragedy. It should be investigated. And if I had a son, he'd look like Trayvon. The shooting is being investigated, and the spotlight is drifting to other cases in which the state's Stand Your Ground law was used in self-defense. Now, there's no one agency that compiles records, so the Tampa Bay Times dug through reports and found that since the Florida law was passed in 2005, there's been a threefold increase in cases, most of them ending in fatalities with few witnesses and few charges or convictions. Ben Montgomery is with the Tampa Bay Times. And Ben, you talked with the executive director of the Florida Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. He says as soon as he heard of the Trayvon Martin case, he pulled his files and found 15 cases he felt were similar. Give us some examples.
Well, the one that stands out immediately is a case that happened recently in Tampa. A white man was jogging through his neighborhood about 1 a.m. and he was confronted by a couple of teenagers. One of them punched him in the face. He was under the impression that they were trying to rob him, and he pulls a pistol, and one of the teens turns to run, and the man opens fire. The teen dies, and charges against the shooter were dropped. He was able to prove that he was in fear for his life, and that's what some have identified as a problem with this law. It asks police, prosecutors, and the court system to consider something as nebulous as a man's state of mind. And unfortunately, in a lot of these cases, you'll have no witnesses. So the burden of proof rests with a person who is solely concerned with keeping him or herself out of jail.
Well, there's another case that's still pending that involved another man who actually went to a neighborhood park. He was legally armed. He was legally carrying a gun to confront a skateboarder, I think. Tell that story.
Yeah, that's correct. Trevor Dooley left his house when he noticed a skateboarder across the street in the park skating on some basketball courts. Another man who was playing basketball on the courts with his daughter tried to confront Dooley, and the two get into an argument and tussle. Trevor Dooley pulls the gun in fear for his life, he's claimed, and shoots the man dead in front of his daughter.
We understand that case is still pending. Is there a sense that the cases that are pending are going to be looked at under a different light because of the Martin case?
I guess that's quite possible, but until the law is repealed or altered, I see them playing out very much the same way they have been in the past 6.5 years.
Give us the overview. What are the stats? How many cases have there been since the law was enacted? How many have gone to court? How many have had the charges dropped, as in the George Zimmerman case?
We found 130 cases in which Stand Your Ground has been invoked. Most of them involve fatality. In 50 of the cases, the person who used force was never charged with the crime. Another 9 defendants were granted immunity by a judge, and 9 cases were dismissed. 28 cases actually made it to trial, and of those, 19 people were found guilty of a crime.
And what are some of the situations? We've heard of a couple, a man out jogging who thought he was being robbed, someone who went to a playground to confront a skateboarder. Where did some of these other cases take place?
There are some extreme cases that certainly have raised a lot of people's eyebrows involving gang shootouts. For instance, a case in Tallahassee in which 2 rival gangs began trading fire and an innocent 15-year-old bystander was hit and killed. The police couldn't bring charges against the shooter because he made the claim that he was in fear for his life because he was being fired on by the rival gang.
We've been hearing that even the people who crafted the law are thinking it may need to be reconsidered.
Yes, ma'am, that's correct. This case, for whatever reason, has finally brought a lot of attention to the law, and there's finally a very public dialogue about what's going on in the cases that don't quite meet the sniff test. For instance, in one shooting early in 2006, you know, a man shot and killed a couple of guys that he was fighting with, and when police came to arrest him, he actually invoked the law by its name, said, "You can't arrest me, because I was standing my ground," and he said, "Jeb Bush told me I could do that," so referring to the former governor who signed the bill into law. Now, that guy, he was actually found guilty of murder and is serving the sentence right now. And I can point to a really interesting case that played out in Pasco County, Florida. A man named Max Wesley Horn got in a confrontation at a street festival. He actually left the festival, got a gun, came back to the festival, and the same guy who was giving him beef before confronted him again. He pulled his weapon and fired. He was acquitted by a jury after serving 2 years' time.
Even though he'd left the scene, gotten a gun, and gone back?
That's correct.
quite something. Ben Montgomery of the Tampa Bay Times, thanks so much for talking to us about Florida's Stand Your Ground law.
My pleasure.
Apple is reporting that at least 600 schools have handed out an iPad to every single student, not just in Tony suburbs, but in less affluent schools in New York, Chicago. Here in the Boston area, Burlington High School went all iPad in the fall. They say it cost them $500,000 and they made cuts elsewhere. No one's left out. They say they've set up their own version of the Apple Store's Genius Bar, staffed in part by students, for the technically challenged. But how does this work? What happens to textbooks? Are kids just playing Angry Birds? We have questions, and Principal Larkin joins us in the studio with answers. So, Principal Larkin, first, cost. We're looking at a graphic. Someone crunched the numbers and says it's much more because you have to factor in training and Wi-Fi network, iPads, and electronic textbooks.
Yeah, I agree with that infographic, by the way, but if you're just looking for these tablets to be textbooks, then I think you're wasting your money, but they're more than just textbooks. What we've done is we've cut out three of our computer labs this year that were traditionally used for research and typing, and we don't need those because we can do that in every classroom at this point. One was our foreign language lab. We were looking for a new foreign language lab at a cost of about $100,000. And with the iPads, we have a foreign language lab in every classroom.
But what about the textbooks?
We don't need to buy textbooks anymore.
You're not going to buy textbooks?
No, we're not.
None?
Textbooks, I believe, are relics. When information was scarce, that's what we got, a textbook. But now when information is plentiful, we can use devices like the iPad. It's not just about the iPad. It's about having a web-enabled device. And the iPad is what we're using right now. Who knows what we'll be using 2 or 3 years from now.
Okay, but textbooks are carefully designed. They're coursework. So who frames the coursework?
I think the learner should frame the coursework, especially at the high school level, the teachers and in some cases the students. If the overarching topic is made clear, why can't the students go off and search for relevant information? I think that's the way learners need to conduct themselves now instead of somebody giving you one static document and saying this is what the correct history of such and such is. Now they can go out and find it themselves. And I think that's a skill that people need to learn in this day and age, is what information is relevant and what is not.
Wait a second. And when we say you're not ordering textbooks, we mean, of course, paper textbooks, but are you ordering e-textbooks?
We're not ordering e-textbooks either. I don't think, at least not pay for ones from the textbook companies, because that's not a cost-saving proposition for high schools either. The initial model was $14.99 a piece out of the Apple Store, and you can't pass those along to the next student. So if a class of freshmen has an Algebra 1 ebook from the Apple iStore for $14.99 a piece, we can't pass that down as a school to the next group of students coming in.
And let's bring in one of your teachers. Todd Witten is chair of the history department. And Todd, your thoughts about this, no textbooks, no ebooks. First of all, have you been doing it?
Yes, we have been doing it. And I have to say, I like it. It's not as though we just threw the curriculum out when we got the iPad. We're still working off of the same stuff that we've been working with. And rather than say to the students, okay, you're going to read this page in class, and then we're just going to go over what you read, I can say to my students, this group over here, look for the Ottoman Empire. This group over here, look for the Safavid Empire. And you guys look for the Mughal Empire. And I want you to focus on leadership. Find me information about the leaders. Throw it up on the LCD screen. We'll talk about what leadership looks like in the Muslim dynasties.
Okay, but how do you trust the source of that? One of the kids finds an episode of The Simpsons,
absolutely,
which discussed the Ottoman Empire.
Well, first of all, The Simpsons is a perfectly valid learning resource at times. So that's part of the lesson. We begin the year by looking at the internet and saying that very question, how do you know to trust this source? And the students have to build that kind of understanding of truth and their own truth. I mean, in my class at this point in the year, if a kid throws something up on the LCD or is sharing something that doesn't sound credible, they jump all over him. They say, where'd you get that from? You got that from here? That's not a good, you know. So they start policing themselves in a way that helps them learn how to use the internet effectively.
But is that efficient use of time? Principal Larkin, who's sitting here, by the way, on his iPad.
Textbooks are not curriculum. Textbooks are guides that help us cover some of the curriculum. I don't think any of us have ever found a textbook that covers every aspect of our curriculum that we have written. So actually here we have much more flexibility. We can go in and change things on the fly when we're creating it ourselves. And I think the only thing we want to be hesitant about is to think differently about what the opportunities are. Like, who are the experts that wrote the textbooks? they didn't talk to the teachers in our classrooms about what they wanted in these books before they came out.
Well, in fact, we understand most textbooks are shaped by what Texas wants. You're nodding yes, because Texas is the largest purchaser of textbooks, and we know that, you know, there's a lot of controversy there over teaching, for instance, creationism in the schools and things like that.
Yeah, it doesn't necessarily always have the point of view of all sides. And I think, again, in the past, we were looking at one document, and Todd would have done the same thing with a traditional textbook to ask his kids, how do we know this is relevant information, or how do we know this is accurate information? And now we can pull in all kinds of different resources rather than just one static thing that was created in Texas.
Well, Todd?
There was just an article in the Boston Globe this past week talking about a new discovery in China that indicates there's a whole other branch of the human species that they've found. If I were relying on my textbook that was published in 2005, I couldn't have that conversation. Whereas I had students who had been, you know, following the Globe online and brought in the article and wanted to talk about it and were able to deconstruct what we had already learned to say, what's the implication of this?
Yeah. What about math? When, you know, the textbooks had the problems and the key with the answers, you know, very straightforward. You're not going to Google around to find different ways to do your algebra.
Correct. That's one reason why I think we can put it together ourselves. Why would we ever buy a new textbook, like you said, when how to solve this problem in algebra hasn't changed for the last 10 years? The one thing we can put in some of these interactive resources, or we can draw upon things like Khan Academy.
Khan Academy is the terrific, we should say, it's the online academy that was just profiled in 60 Minutes, started by this young man, wonderful young man, who started off by doing math problems for his sister online, and it grew where he just was helping everybody do math.
Yeah, and that's free open resource stuff. There's free open education resources out there. The problem right now, what we have to learn how to do as educators and what we want to pass along to our students, because this is new to us, is the process of curation. Like, how do we find relevant things, and as we're having discussions, and how do we know these are accurate representations of what we want to pass along to students? And our students can do that work with us, especially at the high school level. And then you start to get into some of the higher order critical thinking that we want to get to anyway. So I think it's a really exciting time to be an educator. And I think Todd's class is one example of where they're doing this work.
Patrick Larkin, principal of Burlington High School here in Massachusetts, and Todd Witten, head of the history department there. We still have questions, but we tweeted students to ask how they're using their iPads, and one way was to send us back video responses. Here's a portion.
For me, the iPad was really useful just so you could always have access to information.
I'm here all the time after school for musical or swimming or something or other, and just the fact that I have the internet right there and that I can easily access any homework, any studying to do, it makes it so much easier.
As a musician, I use the iPad, a new app called Notarize, where I can take notes right on my music. And I can circle certain bars that I need to skip or tell myself to look ahead and jump a section.
I'm sure you have questions, too. Send them to hereandnow.org. Before the break, the Khan Academy came up. It's K-H-A-N. As a resource for kids, this is a free online site that's found really creative ways to teach math. But Todd, if you send your kids to that site, doesn't it take teaching out of your hands?
No, not so much. The way I look at it is it's supplemental to what the kids are getting from me. The Khan Academy type video is incredibly useful for me. I've got them for 45 minutes, and at the end of 45 minutes, I can tell, you know, Susie still doesn't quite get it. So I can say, listen, as part of tonight's homework, here's what I want you to do. I want you to find, you know, I direct them to a website and I say, you know, watch this video or, you know, do this activity or follow this time stream or thread or what have you, and then come back tomorrow and let's talk about it. So it really gives me the ability to direct them to resources that help them learn even better.
You had some skepticism at first, Todd. So what were your concerns and what's been the reality?
Well, I think, I mean, for me, it's pretty much any teacher would look at this possible game-playing device in the classroom that allows them to go on Facebook and Twitter and play, you know, do all sorts of stuff. And, you know, teenagers, you give them an inch, they're going to take a mile.
Do they? I know kids. I bet they do.
Of course. There are some who do. And so part of my skepticism was I'm going to have 18 kids in my room who are thoroughly distracted. And what I discovered is that if I modify my classroom management style, they're not distracted. I mean, the great thing about the iPad is you just turn it over and it's done. It's basically a shiny piece of metal on your desk.
Principal Larkin, you know there's a whole school of thought that there are some parents desperately trying to keep kids away from technology so they have more tactile time, they develop their brains. You know, there's research that shows as much as you can, keep them away from the technology till they're older. Do you worry about that?
I think, honestly, we're connecting, we're engaging students in ways that kind of fit the world they live in, and I think that's unusual for schools.
And this is high school.
Yeah, we do worry about balance. We have those conversations. What we want to do is tell the parents what the kids have the iPads for, reinforce that, and it's okay for the parents to take the iPad away at home. They should still monitor it. We've gone from a world where we used to tell parents a few years ago to put your computer in a common area so you can keep tabs on what your kids are doing online. And here goes the school and hands them these little mobile devices they can take into their rooms, and they have cameras, and they can have FaceTime chats with their friends or anyone around the world. So it's really important to keep those conversations with parents going and to remind them that we own the device, they own the kid. So whatever they decide they want to do in their home in regards to technology, that's fine with us, and we'll support them on that. I've heard from some students that say, I'm really learning to monitor my, you know, game playing or whatever, because initially that was a distraction. To others that say, I used to get C's and D's, and now I'm so much more organized by having this one device with all of my notes from every class instead of having binders and notebook stuffed in a backpack. So we're hearing both sides, and we're hearing some kids don't like the iPads, and that's fine. I think.
What do you do about that?
There's no problem with them.
But they can't do anything. There's no textbook for them to revert
to. Teachers can, if they prefer to have a printout of something, it's not happening too much, but teachers can print out a copy of something for them if that's what they want to do. I think the good thing we have to realize is we have more choices than we've ever had before. So if people like to take physical notes or read from a physical book, in a lot of cases we're still able to accommodate that, I think that will diminish as we see some of our younger kids move through.
But I think it's also important to remember that it's not that we just suddenly threw all the textbooks into it, you know, into the dumpster and said we're done with them. We still have textbooks in the building. We still do use them. You know, there are some kids who aren't taking to it and some that are. But I think that over time, as we go through, this is it. This is, we're going to see new technologies we can't even imagine coming into the classroom.
Well, in the meantime, when it comes to education, Todd, just give me some examples of things kids have used the iPad for, maybe that you didn't foresee.
Sure, we do. Well, how long do you have? We use an app in my class called Show Me all the time, and it's basically a whiteboard-like application that allows students to take pictures, import them, and then basically draw on them, mess with them, you know, reconfigure them. So for my class, students are, when we're dealing with maps and geography, students are taking snapshots from Google Earth or from Google Maps or even just from physical maps that I have in the room, importing them, and then they can show the transitions of cultures, the growth, the movements of human beings all around the globe, and then they can upload it to a cloud, they can share it with each other, and then they comment on their blogs. They engage themselves in conversations that go well beyond the classroom.
You know, all the kids are in Todd's class are writing blogs. Kids are using Evernote for note-taking, where they have all their notes in one place. We're a Google App school, so that's really been a useful thing for us. Google Docs is a collaborative writing environment where you and I could simultaneously be working on the same document online, and you'd see my typing and I'd see yours, and you can do that with 100 people if you'd like to.
The other difference between a textbook and working on an iPad online is advertising. So when you go into the Google documents, you're delivering a classroom of kids to Google advertisers.
Google doesn't have ads on Google Apps for Education, which we have. There's no advertising on that.
Yeah, if you sidestep it and you use like an app like GWiz, then you do get the ads.
Some of the other, but we have Google Apps for Education suite, so what we offer our kids, now they have access to all kinds of stuff that does have advertising on it, but there's whole states that have gone Google for Education in this country, and right now it's a great option.
Well, you know, one of the things I'm thinking, you know, we air across the country, and I can hear people in school districts where they can't even get chairs for their kids, you know, thinking, oh, my kids are going to be so far behind. How do you integrate your kids from these classrooms as they go to college and, you know, go on? I mean, it just feels like we're going to be making an even bigger divide.
There's no doubt about that, and I think that's a moral issue that people above me have to start dealing with. I think public education, in a lot of cases, I think we really have to question the relevance of what we're doing and what we're preparing them for. And I think this emphasis on standardized testing is not leading our kids to any marketable skills. It's still a big game of trivial pursuit in my mind in a lot of cases, filling in a bubble sheet.
In high school. A bubble sheet. That's where you take the number two pencil.
Yeah, we're doing that this week, actually. No offense to bubble sheets, but we spend way too much time on those things in Massachusetts and in our country.
Your kids, Todd, are going to be thinking, what's this, a pencil? What? You fill in the hole?
Which end do I hold?
I look forward to that day when we have to tell them what that is.
Yeah. We've been talking to Patrick Larkin, principal of Burlington High School in Burlington, Massachusetts, where every single student has an iPad, and one of the teachers there is Todd Witten, head of the history department. Patrick, Todd, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
You kill my brothers, so I am killing you. We're now hearing the words of Mohamed Mira as he shot and killed a Muslim French soldier on March 11th, the start of a killing spree that ended with Mira's death in a police standoff yesterday. Police say Mira made a video of the shooting and of a gruesome attack on a Jewish school, which he posted online. Mira told police he killed three French soldiers, a rabbi, and three young Jewish children in retaliation for the deaths of children in the Palestinian territories, French participation in the war in Afghanistan, and the year-old French law banning full-face Muslim veils. It turns out Mira, a Frenchman of Algerian descent, was well known to French intelligence. He claimed to be a follower of Al-Qaeda. He'd been to Afghanistan and Pakistan, he said, because he was looking for a wife. But the French prime minister said today that authorities never suspected he'd be dangerous, even though he was on the U.S. no-fly watch list. Christopher Dickey is Paris bureau chief for Newsweek. He's reporting in New York. And Chris, you say this gunman represents a slippery new threat. We've talked before about the lone wolf. Tell us more about your thinking.
Well, he's not all that lonely, this lone wolf. He was part of a group of people who were connected to attempts to smuggle jihadists from France into Iraq back in around 2007 at a low level. He went to Afghanistan and the Afghanistan-Pakistan area twice. He was interviewed by the equivalent of the FBI in France as recently as November. In fact, when he was holding out against the police siege, the man who was talking to him was the same guy who had interviewed him in November. But the police convinced themselves that he was really harmless, even that he had a split personality and he was hiding his sinister jihadist personality from them. I mean, the excuses being made in France right now are kind of incredible.
What else might have been at play here? Because you're reporting in New York, as New York officials are being criticized for going too far in monitoring Muslim communities. So,
well, this is just the thing, isn't it? Mm-hmm. What we're criticizing the police in France right now because they had somebody in their sights and they didn't follow him close enough. At the same time, we're criticizing the New York City Police Department for spreading the blanket of surveillance too wide and looking at too many people. The fact is, when you have any kind of suspicion, you have to follow it up as a police force. I just interviewed Kathy Lanier, the police chief in Washington. She said, you know, the intelligence that's gathered by the NYPD is shared with other police forces all around the country and much needed by them. But no police force has enough resources to keep everyone under surveillance. That's one of the things that's kind of preposterous about the allegations made against the NYPD. They don't have the resources to keep every mosque under surveillance. They don't keep every student group under surveillance. Far from it. It's only when they have reason to believe that there's some kind of covert activity going on in those places or in those groups that they focus their attention on.
Well, but, you know, there's further criticism of the New York police that they went beyond their bounds. They were in New Jersey. It's, you know, and there are people who, you know, in the Muslim community. I mean, this is the tension. What's it like in Paris? Because here the tension is people feel they're being, you know, targeted. In Toulouse, you know, this man killed Muslim soldiers. So,
sure. And in fact, in the ceremonies being held in Toulouse today, there are banners being unfurled talking about Christians, Jews, Muslims all together. We all believe in one God, the God of love. I mean, there's this effort to say we can all live together as a community. And indeed, they can and they do, especially in Toulouse and in southern France. There's much higher level of integration than there is in the northern cities, including Paris. So this can be a very positive thing. But the truth is, a lot of people in the Muslim community, although they know it, they are under a lot of surveillance, that a lot of certainly radical-type mosques are under a lot of surveillance in France and penetrated by agents in France, they don't really object to it because they see extreme violent radicalism as a threat to their own well-being.
Well, outside of the questions as to, you know, how police are doing their surveillance, you say the bottom line is the thinking has to be that these lone wolves are the threat.
Well, they're the hardest to find. Now, the irony in this case is that this was a lone wolf who probably wasn't all that lonely. He was connected to other people, and they still didn't manage to figure out how dangerous he was.
Christopher Dickey, Paris Bureau Chief for Newsweek. You can also read him on the Daily Beast. We'll link it here and now.org. Chris, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Meat has been in the news. Pink slime is the lean beef trimming that's treated with ammonia before being added to ground beef. The National School Lunch Program was buying 7 million pounds of ground beef that contained pink slime. An uproar ensued, and the USDA ruled that schools can choose to order ground beef minus the slime. We'll have a thought on that in a few minutes. But then we noticed a story about Chinese Olympic athletes being told to raise their own chickens for food and to steer clear of meat at restaurants in China. What an image, athletes tossing grain out to their chickens as they practice tossing the javelin. Well, it turns out that many food animals in China are given clenbuterol, which is meant to put more meat on the animals, but when used by humans, is an illegal performance-enhancing substance like steroids and is banned by the World Anti-Doping Agency. The Chinese Olympic Committee feared their athletes would fail drug tests after eating meat that contained clenbuterol. So what is it? And is it in meat here? Scott Hurd is an assistant professor at the College of Veterinary Medicine at Iowa State University, former member of the Food Safety Inspection Service at the USDA. Dr. Hurd, start right there. What is clenbuterol?
Well, clenbuterol, Robin, is officially what's called a repartitioning agent, and it has an interesting effect in the body in that it actually causes energy and protein to be moved into muscle instead of being deposited into fat. It's also, these types of drugs are used to help with asthma in people and in horses and dogs.
So it's a performance-enhancing drug. It's banned by the World Anti-Doping Agency. Do we have it here?
Here in the United States, we do have it. As I said, it's used for treatment, respiratory disease in humans and in animals, but it is not in food animals. In fact, globally, the use of clenbuterol in food animals is illegal.
Well, but is there something that mimics it or works in the same way?
Well, there is another product that acts the same way, but you won't test positive if you eat meat from animals that are treated legally with another repartitioning agent called ractopamine. That's used by about 80% of swine in the U.S. and a large number of pigs, but that's a much different compound. It doesn't have the toxicity that clenbuterol. It quickly clears from the animal, and it is FDA approved and shown to be safe and effective.
So it won't read as a steroid, presumably, for...
No, you can eat that stuff all day long and you will not test positive on a drug test.
But are there side effects with ractopamine of any other kind?
No, not that FDA has been able to detect. They put all of these drugs through, serious tests for a safety and that sort of thing. And the other thing to keep in mind is that these compounds are found naturally in the human body. That's one of the things that's important for smooth muscle relaxation, which is why they use it in treatment of asthma victims and that sort of thing. So these are not weird compounds from outer space. These are compounds that are found in the body, and that's how we find out how they work. We use them in animals to increase the efficiency, reduce the carbon footprint, and that sort of thing. Once it gets to the dinner plate, there's virtually none of it left in the meat, and it's not going to harm anyone nor make them test positive on drug tests.
Well, but, you know, there are people who worry about this. Ractopamine is banned in, I believe, 100 to 160 countries, depending on the count you get. People in Taiwan were very much against it. They felt that they were being, held hostage to a trade war, that rather than take a look at the health effects of ractopamine, it was more important to get the trade with the U.S. meat that contained it. And I'm reading on the Bentley University McCallum Graduate School website comments about how on the drug there is a warning that says not for use in humans. Individuals with cardiovascular disease should exercise special caution to avoid exposure, use protective clothing, protective eyewear, and a dust mask. A columnist, Martha Rosenberg, asks, how can that, when it's so dangerous, to humans in the form it's given to animals, become safe in the food that they eat?
Well, it's just like virtually any other medicine or compound. Essentially, the poison's in the dose. By the time it's been fed to an animal in an appropriate dose and goes through the metabolism and all, there's virtually none left in the meat. Of course, if you were to eat the feed the pigs were consuming, and if you had some risk factors, like they said, cardiovascular disease, then that might be a problem. Keep in mind, as I said, these products are used routinely. My kid used to take it all the time for asthma. So they are medications, and they need to be used appropriately. Back to the question of whether people want to avoid, you know, any sort of additive in the meat, certainly that's an appropriate choice. And there's trade-offs on both sides of that.
And why would someone want to add rectopamine to food animals?
Well, it harmlessly greatly increases the efficiency of production, so that it takes less oil, it takes less space, it takes less ground, it takes less feed in order to get food on the dinner table.
Yeah, so we circle back to, you know, if there's a demand for meat, meat producers have to come up with a way to get it to people's tables. And we know that you consult with the industry, do research for the industry. What do you make of reports that, again, the drug is banned in Europe, Taiwan, China, and a claim that more than 1,700 people have been poisoned from eating pigs fed ractopamine since 1998?
Well, I spent the first 12 years with the USDA, including a year as the Deputy Undersecretary for Food Safety, and I have 8 children, so my first concern is public health. Claims that 1,700 people have been made sickened by it, I guarantee you it was not used legally. If that was the case, it was not approved compound, so it could have been a bootleg version of ractopamine, or it could have been clenbuterol. The thing to keep in mind with clenbuterol is if someone tests positive for that, they likely did not get it from animals, from meat, and unless those meat were somehow produced illegally.
Dr. Scott Hurd, assistant professor at the College of Veterinary Medicine at Iowa State University. By the way, pink slime, your thoughts on pink slime?
Well, pink slime is essentially the finer version of the ground beef. You can have large chunks, you can have small chunk. It is still beef. The treatment with ammoniation is perfectly harmless. The alternative is E. coli 0157, and the people are very concerned about that. It kills children, so you're going to increase your risk if you avoid things that have been treated with this ammoniation. So it's, again, it's a trade-off. Ammoniation is harmless. 0157 kills people. To me, the answer is pretty straightforward.
Dr. Hurd, thank you.
All right. Thank you, Robin.
We haven't heard that in a while, have we? Mad Men has been off the air for the last year and a half because of a dispute between the producers and the program's creator, Matthew Weiner, which has been resolved. So the show returns to the AMC cable channel Sunday with a 2-hour season premiere. And Here and Now critic at large Ed Siegel joins us with a little of that and a little about another AMC series, The Killing. So, Ed, how you doing? Because the last time you were here, we spoke about Downton Abbey. And boy, it's hard to remove those tar and feathers, isn't it? We gave away a little too much of the plot points for people's tastes, but we won't do that now. But before we go forward, go back for people who are just jumping in after 4 seasons. This is the 5th season of Mad Men.
Okay.
Just a quick thumbnail.
All right. Well, you know, the title Mad Men refers to the slightly insane world of advertising in the, particularly the 60s, the world of gazillion martini lunches. The men were all drunks and sexists, and the women were ornaments, but the times, they are a-changing.
They are a-changing. And we're going to get to some of the changes, but those first 4 seasons, did they hold up? I mean, they were certainly heralded.
Yeah, well, you know, I was a fan of the show right from the start, Robin, but I thought that the past season or two got a little tired. Don Draper, the lead character of the show, got increasingly drunk. His ex-wife Betty got increasingly mean-spirited, and the storyline went a little too over the top, I thought.
Well, it ended, and we're not giving anything away because it was the end of last year. It ended with the surprise of Don proposing to his secretary, Megan, and so is that where we pick up Don and Megan?
Yeah, it was quite a shock, and Jessica Pare as Megan not only gives Don a new lease on life, but she breathes a lot of fire into the show as well. particularly when she does a little Jane Birkin, Bridget Bardot, mini-skirted dance number for him at his 40th birthday party. The guests, they're both shocked and delighted as they look on.
Dans les buissons sous le ciel du mois d'août, les amoureux glissent à pas de loup. Comme les oiseaux, ils ont rendez-vous. On entend partout.
So Ed, when it comes to the women in the show, you said times they are changing, but apparently not a lot, judging from that scene.
No, maybe not, but what I really love about the show is the way it traces the last stages of the 1950s as it's turning into the early stages of the 60s. The program, in fact, opens with a group of civil rights marchers being pelted by water bombs from the windows of Young and Rubicam, a rival advertising agency.
Well, there are a lot of things depicted in the show that people look at in horror, like, I can't believe that we used to do that. But it reflects a lot of literature of the period. I know that's another reason why you like it.
Yeah, that's right. Everything from The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit by Sloan Wilson to Allen Ginsberg's Howl. I doubt that either of those writers held the advertising industry in high esteem, but Matthew Weiner has been absolutely brilliant in the way he uses the advertising to chart the changes we've been talking about here. We're going to listen to the men from Heinz Beans come in and tell Don Draper and company to get with the program when an advertising pitch goes bad.
Beans is the war, the depression, bomb shelters. We have to erase that. They have to be cool. Don, you know what I'm talking about. I want the kids in college. It's convenient. They have the hot plate. They're sitting in. Maybe it's someone with a picket sign saying, we want beans.
You know what, Raymond? This is our job from here on out. We'll make you happy.
Yeah, a picket sign, you know, sort of co-opting the anti-war movement for beans. But Matthew Weiner, in addition to sort of those popular cultural references, he also likes to use the personal lives of his characters to illustrate this transition from the 50s to the 60s. And I'm you know, thinking of women. We made a quick reference to the secretary. But tell us more about that.
The women are under the thumb of the men in the agency. And this new season, he uses Christina Hendricks as Joan. She's the Marilyn Monroe-ish secretary who began the series as Roger Sterling's mistress.
Roger Sterling is the John Slattery character.
That's right. You might remember that Joan left Roger and married a doctor, and he's in the army now. So Joan's mother is helping her take care of the new baby, who's actually Roger's baby, not the military guy's. And she's telling her daughter she should put thoughts about going back to work aside.
I don't want to break my promise. And Greg will be stationed at Fort Dix for a second year. I can commute from New Jersey.
And then?
And then, when he's done, we'll see.
Joan, he's not going to allow you to work.
Allow me?
Whither thou goest, I will go.
And how did that work out for you?
So in this strand, you have so many storylines. You have, you know, the Vietnam War on the horizon with a husband who's in the army. You have a woman struggling to understand that she may not be able to go back to work. Or, you know, there's a lot going on there. How about this fifth season? Do you like it?
Yeah, it was definitely worth the wait back to doing what it's done well all along.
But then there's another AMC show we want to make sure we ask you about.
Yep.
The Killing. You weren't so happy with the way it ended last year.
No, me and everybody else.
Tell us about the show.
It's based on a Danish series in which each episode charts a day in the investigation of the murder of a teenage girl. And during that season, viewers had the impression that we would learn the identity of the killer at the end of the year. Instead, they just left us hanging when the prime suspect was shot. But then we learn he may have been framed for the murder all along, and see you next year.
I mean, this goes beyond shows where they take the season to come to the ending. I mean,
that's right.
What's going to happen this year?
Yes, they have promised that we'll find out at the end of the second year. And I have to say that they won me back with this first episode. The atmospherics are sensational, as they've always been. The eerie music and the rainy Seattle landscape that suggests menace and corruption.
Open the door, Lynn. I know you're in there. I need to talk to you. I can explain. Linda, just open the door, Linda.
Linda, open the door. So shades of Twin Peaks with that Seattle feel?
Yes, except that this isn't at all surreal. It's obvious that the two detectives, Lyndon and Holder, they become convinced that there's a police conspiracy attached to the murder of the teenage girl. The only problem is that Lyndon thinks Holder's a part of it.
Ah, so we have a buddy film, but maybe one of the buddies gone bad.
Yeah, Detective Holder, he's played by Joel Kinnaman. Here he's talking with one of his colleagues doing a Tarantino-like rap about Chinese food and cheeseburgers until a bullet shot interrupts him.
You work in the 11 to 6 shift?
What do you want, Ray?
Me and the guys are ordering Chinese. You in?
All you guys eat is that Fu Manchu poo-poo platter MSG crap.
And your double cheeseburgers hold the meats organic?
At least it's got some vegetables in it. What, it's got lettuce, tomatoes, pickles?
Yeah, pickles are not vegetables.
Pickles are vegetables? What are you talking about?
Politically correct, he ain't, but, you know, Robin, it's fascinating to watch his angels do battle with his devils. It's hard to tell whether he's a good bad guy or a bad good guy.
But two good shows coming out of the AMC.
Yeah, AMC, you know, is the hot network.
The Killing and Mad Men. It seems like one has guns and in the other you just get stabbed in the back. Season 2 of The Killing premieres April 1st. Mad Men opens its fifth season this Sunday. And we'll end with a song that closes out the season opener. Dusty Springfield brings it to us. Ed Siegel, Here and Now's critic at large. Ed, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin, and thank you, Dusty.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.